Good morning. A brighter day is here. Good morning. May we bring you cheer.
We've got time. We've got tunes. We've got time, tunes, and temperature.
Get up and go. It's today, you know, on KSCO Radio.
Hey, everybody.
Yeah, welcome to the Saturday special. Our Steve Jobs Memorial today with Dan Kottke, Steve's best friend.
And this is Mr. and Mrs. Future. See ya in the Saturday special.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.
Okay, we are going to do a little memorial on Steve. Steve Jobs, that is. Apple itself was a big part of our community and still is. Santa Cruz and the environs around us played some key roles in its evolution in terms of friends and support and that sort of thing. So today we're going to delve a little bit into the history of the icon known as Apple, the mythology and the real story. As far as we know, we have a special guest on today, Dan Kottke, who is distinguished in that he was one of Steve's best friends in college. They used to do all kinds of things together, which you will hear. They went to India together and then started Apple, and Dan was there for the whole story. And I have a little piece from Steve Wozniak here that talks about his experience.
I was so stunned because I have very dramatic memories of where I was when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, when I heard that JFK had been shot, and this I'll never get this memory out of my head, just where I was, just getting a phone call from a reporter, and they just said, "Have you heard the news?" And I instantly knew what that meant, and it was just a total shock. Like, what do you say? It's like the world lost a John Lennon. I mean, Steve was clearly the most outstanding business thinker, and almost everybody who's high up in the technology business recognized that somehow he had the ability to think out new ways of doing things, not just ways to improve what we have, do a better version of something, but do it in a totally different way that the world would swing towards. And then I think back to just all the times we had together, very, very good times that you have when you're young, you know, and playing around with the systems and little misbehavior and doing interesting things. And then he was always thinking about certain technology, the early products that got developed, the building parts, what those might lead to in our future. And he was always pushing me as an engineer, could you possibly add this someday? Could you possibly add that someday? Yes, 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 I could, thinking, no, it's way, way off. But eventually we all did. We went into the garage when we were two young people with no money. You have to work out of your home. We had jobs on the side. We had nobody that could loan us money. We had no business experience. We're like a million young people who are so excited about the future they might have someday in business, making something just out of their ideas. That's what we were. And over and over and over, all the products of Apple, from, you know, iPhones and iPads, iPods, these were just unbelievable life changers. And almost everyone who heads a technology company looks at Steve Jobs as, where did he get the ideas to do it the right way? We were just the lucky partnership. He was lucky to have me in the beginning, but I am much, you know, incredibly lucky to him for everything in my life. He gets a reputation for being a strong leader and being brash, but to me, he was just always so kind, such a good friend, and I'm just going to miss him.
All right, Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, we have Daniel on Skype. Hey, Daniel, how you doing?
Hi. Thanks to the magic of Macintosh, it actually figured out that my Skype version was too old, so I had to go download the new one and install it and run it, and it all worked.
Oh, fantastic.
Except so this is a newer version. Where's the button for video? There it is.
Uh-huh.
There we go.
You see the sun over in the other room there?
No, I don't.
Oh, I'm keeping the video off. I don't want it to crash. But I see you. Hi, Daniel.
Okay.
Okay, great. Anyway, we're here to think about these passing times represented by Steve Jobs. Many people I talked to were saying how the moment when they found out that Steve Jobs passed was like finding out that Kennedy had gone, or Jerry, or they were comparing it to really epic moments in their life. Did you find it that way, Daniel?
I was in the middle of an exciting phone call with Gary Leo, former Apple engineer, talking about a design for a power monitoring system product. And my son came in the room and turned on the TV.
So it was your son that helped you see
it? It was my son who told me.
So was
that Woz I just heard minutes ago?
Yeah, that was a Woz piece where he talked about the minute that he found out and what was going on with him. Yeah, it was pre-recorded.
That was nice to hear his voice.
Yeah, he was really touched. You knew Steve before Woz even, right? Didn't you guys go back to Reed College together?
Yeah, but I actually just learned in the New York Times article that Woz and Jobs, the two Steves, met in the electronics lab at Homestead High. I had never heard that.
Oh, well, so that does predate you then.
Yeah, and the funny thing is Woz is 4 years older. If you think about how many kids you knew in high school who were 4 years ahead of you, not very many.
That you actually knew.
Yeah, so I had always wondered about how they actually met.
Hmm. Was it electronics class?
There was a teacher there who had an electronics lab at Homestead High. You know, I'm jealous. I would have wanted to do a lab like that. My high school had nothing of the sort.
And you were on the East Coast at the time, right?
Yeah.
High school, Westchester?
Yeah, you know, I was very interested in electronics in junior high. I built a walkie-talkie kit. Mm-hmm. I don't know, what, seventh grade, maybe sixth grade. But there was just nothing going on in my town. There wasn't even a Radio Shack. There was no place to get parts. So I had some popular electronics magazines. I bet I still have those magazines somewhere. I should try and find them.
You were in Westchester County, New York, right? Like New Rochelle, White Plains.
Yes, I grew up right next to New Rochelle. Uh-huh. And my hometown high school is where Felix Cavalieri of the Young Rascals went. The Young Rascals came out of Pelham High.
Well, ironically enough, New Rochelle was also the home of one of the first computer stores in the area in New Rochelle, Tandy of Radio Shack fame.
I never heard that.
Yeah, I actually worked there. I remember.
Are you kidding?
Seriously.
In what year?
In 77, 78 time period. Something like
that. Wow. That's amazing. So 77, it was June of 77, I finished my bachelor's degree at Columbia College. So I was living in Manhattan that year on 113th Street.
When did you and Steve get connected? I know you were a college roommate.
We met up in September of 1972, almost 40 years ago next year, as freshmen in college. He was in a different dorm from me, but I was friends with someone else who was in his dorm. I went over to visit them one day. And that's how I met Steve. He had this big reel-to-reel TAC tape deck with hours of bootleg Bob Dylan. And he was a Dylan fanatic. It was just remarkable that he would have this expensive piece of equipment.
The only guy in the dorm with a four-track TAC tape recorder?
Yes, that's right. I suppose it would have been four tracks. I was very naive about technical gear, so I didn't really know anything about it.
You weren't a techie yet. Right,
I was not at all a techie.
And little did you realize that would be part of your destiny.
True. I didn't realize.
But are you saying Steve was in the sense that he used the gear to listen to what he wanted to hear? It's almost presaging the iPod in that sense.
Yes, that's right. That's right. A little big.
A little big, but it did the job.
Right.
So did you hit it off right away?
We did, actually. Well, our friendship developed because within just a couple of weeks, I had gone into the Apple bookstore and Be Here Now had just arrived.
Oh, Ram Dass's classic title.
Funny square blue book. And it was $3.33. So it was in my budget. And I bought this book, and it was really a mind bender. I had never seen a book like that. I had never actually I read widely in high school, but I had never been exposed to Eastern literature at all.
So that was really it, huh? Be Here Now.
That was really it. He got the book at the same time. So we had discussions about what's going on. Hmm. What's going on in this book? And then out of those discussions, out of that interest.
He became a Buddhist ultimately, it seems.
I don't think he ever really associated with Buddhism as a religion. His main interest area was Zen, which is Buddhism. But Be Here Now is not Buddhism. It's Advaita Vedanta, right? Which is older than Buddhism. Like Neem Karoli Baba was not a Buddhist, okay? Not that he was not embracing Buddhism, but he was part of an older, deeper tradition than Buddhism.
Is it Hindu?
Yeah, it's fair to call it Hindu, but it's Vedanta. The Vedas of India are thousands of years old. Advaita means oneness, consciousness. So Advaita Vedanta, it's just non-dualistic, non-theistic spirituality deriving from the Vedas.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And you and Steve had these discussions on it, and ultimately, I guess that's what led to your trip to India.
Yeah, where did you get the idea to go visit Neem Karoli Baba? How'd that come around?
I traced that back to Robert Friedland, who I've been trying to get back in touch with. I think Robert was a big influence on Steve. He was a big influence on me, too. Robert was 5 years older than us. Huh. When we arrived as freshmen at Reed, he was running for student body president, and he won. And he was a very handsome, very charismatic guy with long blonde hair and blue eyes, very Nordic. He was very full of confidence and enthusiasm. He had been to India like in 1970 or 71, and he was part of that Be Here Now book. He was in the book. The photo of him with the whole crowd of people around Ram Dass, I don't know if that photo was in the book, but there was a photo from those times showing him. He is the one who, a year or two later, told us that we should go and told us where we should stay and who to go call up. And he kind of set us on course. He was a Reed student, but he was graduating when we were freshmen. Very interesting guy. If you look him up on Wikipedia, there's an entry about him that's not exactly glowing. He founded a company called Galactic Resources. He was very wealthy before Steve Jobs was wealthy. I'll put it that way. He's a billionaire. Myanmar. Where is Myanmar? I don't know. He's got mining interests in Myanmar.
Okay. Myanmar, is that
Singapore? Is Myanmar... I think Burma turned into Myanmar.
Burma.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, Summitville Mining Toxic Waste Cleanup Site. Have you heard of that? The biggest toxic waste site in the United States. That was his project. Thank you very much, Robert.
Cleaning it up, that is.
Yes. Well, he got into heap leach mining. Heap leach mining is where you take low-grade ore tailings and you pour hydrochloric acid through it. It dissolves the gold. You catch the acid, and you're left with this mountain of toxic slag. Sounds great. It was Robert Friedland who set us on a course to go to India.
Awesome.
And I didn't have any money, so it wasn't an option for me. Steve had, the second year of our college, Steve had left and gone to work at Atari, got himself a job as a technician at Atari. So he had money, and he got Atari to send him to Switzerland to be a technician for some problem they were having with video games, the Pong video games in Europe.
Really? So Steve was in Europe to investigate tech problems for Atari video games.
Yes. I was amazed because I didn't know anything about technology, and I didn't even know Steve had a background in technology. So Steve offered to buy me my ticket. The tickets were $800 round trip.
For the Indian trip. Okay,
that was a lot of money back then.
Sure was, yeah.
You think Steve Jobs bought your ticket to India?
No, he offered. He offered to loan me the money to buy it. Which was very generous of him. So I said, good, well, let's go. And then I told my parents, and they said, oh, no, 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 we're buying you a round-trip ticket. We want you to come back.
Did Steve buy a round-trip ticket as well?
We both had round-trip tickets. Steve's return ticket was in early August, and mine wasn't till late August.
Yeah.
I was on my own for about a month after he left. And that's when I went up to Dalhousie and took a month-long Vipassana retreat with Goenka, the master. I had my guru experience. Somebody was asking about that yesterday. Steve didn't have a guru experience, really, because Neem Karoli had gone.
Well, wait a minute. So you got there. The guru you were looking for was dead?
Yeah. Neem Karoli had passed away in early 1974, just earlier the same year.
I heard, is it true that that's where the origin of the Apple Credo of the journey is the reward came from?
You went
there and the guru was dead?
No, I never heard that. I don't know. The journey is the reward. That was much later. That was during the Macintosh era. And I don't know where Steve got that from. I think the line about some artists copy, but great artists steal. Remember that line?
Yeah.
He got that line from Picasso. Uh-huh. That was actually, so the Macintosh project, that was Steve's baby. And that was where he really became a showman. You know, if you kind of think back, he wasn't the showman of the Apple II so much. He was the entrepreneur.
Yeah.
It was during the Macintosh, because it was really his baby. he took a great pride in it. So that's when he started being the showman.
Well, before we get into that, I think we'll take a little break here.
Okay.
A couple minutes, get some of our sponsors in. I also want to hear a little bit about the first days of Apple. What phase of the company did you come in at? I'd like to hear a little bit about that, and then the success of the Apple II, and then a little bit about the Mac.
Okay, great.
Sure.
So we'll be back in just a few minutes. Thanks a lot, Daniel.
All right.
Okay.
Okay, we're back on the Saturday special with myself, Al Lundell, and my wife's son, Lundell, also known as Dr. and Mrs. Future on the Tuesday shows. We're here with Dan Kottke, one of the grand old men of Apple, who predates Apple as a friend of Steve Jobs. We were just talking about some of the early history, how they went together on a spiritual search before they started Apple. And that's an interesting chapter I'd like to delve a little bit more into, Dan. Were you guys there for the summer in India? Did you have any spiritual experiences together while you're there?
Not really.
So you were just traveling around visiting ashrams and stuff and meditating? Yeah.
Yes. Were we even meditating? No.
What did you do?
We were backpacking. I was the one who had the stack of books that we were carrying around. Would you like to hear the list of books that we had?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
We were sharing the books.
You and Steve?
Yeah.
And you were having discussions on these books in your India adventures?
So I had a couple of Alan Watts books. I was reading Alan Watts. He was a favorite of mine. Milarepa, The Thousand Songs of Milarepa, who was a yogi. You know Milarepa?
No, I don't know Milarepa myself. But.
He's really famous character in stories of masters.
Yeah, well, and Milarepa is considered the patriarch, the founder of the Kagyu lineage of Tibetan Buddhism. I think Chogyam Trungpa. Kagyu is the crazy wisdom yogis, the cave dwellers. Milarepa lived in a cave and lived on nettles and, you know, was an actual person, but, you know, he's kind of been mythologized like Paul Bunyan.
Gotcha.
Anyway.
Yeah. Was he alive then, too? Was he one of the...
No, he was in the 12th century.
Oh, 12th century. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, so I had a book about Milarepa. I think we had a Lama Govinda book. Probably had a Ramakrishna book. Ramakrishna and his disciples. Uh-huh. Can't remember anymore.
Well, that's a good start. It gives you an idea of what you guys are up to.
I had Jack Kerouac's The Dharma Bums, and I read that when I was in Dharamsala, getting visa renewed. And little did I suspect that Gary Snyder, who was a character in the book, he was a Reedy. None of us knew that.
Meaning you all went to Reed College.
Yes, yes. I didn't find that out till, gosh, just a few years ago.
Too funny. Now, did you have any indication or any inclination you'd be starting a technology company after this journey? Was that in your mind at all?
Not only no indication of that, but... I tell you, I was probably Steve's best friend. Yeah, I was his best friend. His other friends were Lawrence Phillips. Mm-hmm. He had a huge crush on Joelle, who never returned his affections.
Joelle.
Joelle Shallon. I actually tracked her down on Facebook. She lives in Brooklyn.
And she was a love interest of Steve?
She was Steve's big crush. But Steve already had a girlfriend back in Los Altos. I didn't know that at the time.
And he was your best friend? You didn't know that?
No, he never talked about Chris Ann.
Okay. The mother of Lisa.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, I never even knew that Steve had a background in electronics. The funny thing is, I didn't find out, you know, he started doing the blue boxes in 1973, 74.
That was before.
And I never even knew about it. He never talked about it. He never talked about the blue box.
Wow. And that was before the India trip.
Yes, before the India trip. So the famous Esquire article about Captain Crunch, that came out in 1971. Woz was at Berkeley, and Jobs came up to Berkeley to visit him and meet John Draper.
I had written a story on that with Janine called The Merry Pranksters of Microcomputing.
Yes,
you search for that on the net, you can find it. And it was a hilarious chapter. I didn't realize you didn't know Steve then. That was before your time with him. Interesting. Well, or that was parallel in a way, because you were at Reed in 72, and he did this down in Berkeley, I guess, when he wasn't up at Reed.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't an enrolled student. He was just hanging out. So he would disappear from time to time and go back down to the Bay Area. You know, we didn't have cell phones or email in those days, so...
Right, right. So it's a different world, separate worlds.
Yeah. So, and then I think I had come out here in 1975. Uh-huh. So India trip was 74. 75, I came out to visit him.
In Cupertino?
Yeah. I was also visiting Elizabeth, my girlfriend. She lived in Saratoga.
Oh, convenient.
Elizabeth Holmes. Huh. She lives in Healdsburg now. I was just traveling around.
Did Steve have an apartment back then, or was he still living at home?
Steve lived at his parents' house. The first few times I visited, I would sleep on the floor in his bedroom. His bedroom was very tiny. There wasn't room for two of us. I slept on the floor in his bedroom, and he took a different room, I guess. The summer of 76, I spent most of the summer sleeping on the couch in his parents' living room. They were very gracious. They were very hospitable. His father was an Okie, okay? So he had an earthy sense of humor. He was a very down-home guy. His mother, Clara, was very warm and loving woman.
Hmm. So when you came in 75, you stayed at their house, and that was to visit your girlfriend at the same time, and was that when the idea of Apple began around that period of time?
No, I don't really know.
It was more of something that he was cooking up with Woz at that time.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the funny thing is, he never talked about the electronics at all. The one anecdote I was going to share is once in like 1972, 73 it must have been, I ran into Steve in the coffee shop at Reed College. And he had a pad of grid paper, and he was drawing timing diagrams. And I had no idea what in the world he was doing. I could not figure it out. It wasn't a circuit diagram. It was timing diagrams.
And timing diagrams.
He was working on one of the video games. The one that they did for Atari was Simple Simon Says, something like that.
Oh, I remember there was one where you had to remember a pattern and then repeat it back again.
I think it's called Simon Says or something like that.
Okay, so anyway, he was still involved with Bushnell and Atari and the Atari games.
Well, that was just when he was starting his involvement there.
Gotcha.
I'm just telling the anecdote to say he was secretive. He had like these whole areas of his mind that he was very quiet about. And he was not overly talkative. You would call him a quiet guy. I was the more outgoing of the two of us.
That's right. You guys, you and Woz, tended to be more open source kind of guys.
Yes. So Woz, actually, I met Woz when he came up to Reed College to visit Steve. In 72 or 73. I would have been very interested to hear about the blue boxing, but neither of them said a word about it. And it was illegal, I suppose, so they were just being discreet.
Was Steve still into his spiritual books at that point, too?
Yes.
You still had conversations on various philosophers?
Yes, and let's see, I think 1970, well, actually, I think it was after the Indian trip, so it was about 1975, he got into Gurdjieff. He's the one who turned me on to Gurdjieff. I had never heard of that.
Gurdjieff, really?
Meetings with Remarkable Men was a very influential book on Steve. Gurdjieff was very resourceful. Do you know the story?
I know a bit about Gurdjieff, actually. Yeah, he was considered one of the crazy wisdom masters.
Yes, that's right. He was a crazy wisdom master.
Western tradition.
He was meetings with remarkable men. Steve and I went to see that movie together, and we both just really loved that movie. That was years later.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, too.
Yeah, Gurdjieff was hugely resourceful. He used to go into a town and set up shop as a fix-it guy and fix anything that somebody brought him. I'd never heard of such a thing.
That is interesting. That was 75. That was about the time that Apple was actually beginning, the first year, right?
Yes, that's right. So the Altair came out in 75, probably January 75.
And you guys were more towards September, were you, for Apple?
Was the first Apple partnership started in the spring of 76. When I arrived in June of 76, Steve had already produced the logic boards. And I think he had already made the first round of deliveries. I wasn't there. I'm not really sure. I don't remember serializing the boards. So when I showed up in June of 76, Steve's sister Patty was plugging chips onto the Apple I logic boards on the coffee table in the living room while she watched TV. Okay?
What did they recruit you to do? What was the first thing you did?
I took over from her. It's like, all right, Mr. Kaki will be taking over the chip plugging in now.
How many boards did you guys do back then? That was the first run for the bite shops?
They were all for the bite shops. There was nobody else buying them. And in fact, the whole company started because Paul Terrell, who owned the bite shops, he had several bite shops. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know anything about computers, so I didn't really understand what was going on. I had never been in a computer store. I didn't know anything about the Altair or the IMSI.
You could be sit there, plug in chips, watch TV, or talk about Gurdjieff.
Well, no. At that time, we moved it all from the coffee table in the living room into the garage.
Okay, so it's fair to say you came in at the living room phase of the company.
That's right. I came in at the living room phase. And actually, before the living room, Apple started in the spare bedroom.
In the spare bedroom.
There, what happened there? It was Patty had moved out.
Steve's sister.
Yeah, Steve's sister.
So her room was available for production.
I should look her up. She's still around.
Seems like a good time to.
Anyway, there is actually a photo of the very first Apple I boards in boxes of parts, and it's all in Patty's bedroom. It was the spare bedroom. That picture was taken just a few weeks before I arrived.
And then you came in at the living room phase. And how long did that last before the Apple One moved to the garage?
Pretty much the day I arrived. Then we really started setting it up in the garage. Steve's father had found him a big lab bench, and they had an oscilloscope, and they had a big monitor. They had a power supply, not much test equipment. I suppose there was a voltmeter.
Mm-hmm.
So my job was plugging in all the chips and testing the boards.
And Steve's dad was there, too, to help out. Was he still working as well?
He worked full time.
Yeah.
He was very supportive. You know, Steve had really nice parents.
Daniel, where were you guys taking all of these boards? Was this all going down to the Homebrew Computer Club? I mean, how did people even know about computers at this point in time?
Well, the Apple I definitely grew out of the Homebrew Computer Club.
But then Steve had gotten that first big contract with Byte Shops to get them delivered, right?
Yes, that's right. But it's fair to say that Woz designed the Apple One. I mean, first it was just a prototype. It's fair to say that he built that so he could show it off at the Homebrew Computer Club. He didn't build it thinking he was going to sell it.
Right.
It's pretty clear. He didn't build it thinking he was going to sell it. So here's an interesting part of the story. I didn't learn this until just a few years ago. At the Computer History Museum, they had a prototype of
TV typewriter of some sort?
TV typewriter. That's it. Thank you. It was a cover story of Popular Electronics magazine. So it was a public domain design. They gave the design away and Woz had built one. And what this TV typewriter did is it allowed you to connect a keyboard. It gave you a 1 kilobyte text buffer, 40 characters times 24 lines, and it put out video. And, you know, that's actually the most difficult part of the design of the Apple II. To get the video signals right, you need a long count chain. All the signals have to line up. Television is very precise. He got that all for free from Popular Electronics. The funny thing is, when I showed up, I had never heard of the TV typewriter till years later. And I'm looking at the Apple I and going, wow, this guy's an amazing wizard.
Well, I guess Woz kept up on the journals and he believed in sharing information and open source, so it kind of makes sense.
He had actually already built a computer in junior high school. He and Bill Fernandez built a computer called the Cream Soda Computer when they were in high school. In this electronics lab, we were talking about the Homestead High electronics lab.
Yeah.
I don't know the guy's name. I never met him. Chris Espinoza would know. Chris Espinoza went to the same high school.
Hey, Daniel.
Yeah.
We have a phone call from our friend Eva, who we thought would be fun to get in on this because,
sure,
you know, she was in charge of Abacus when our little computer company got a contract with Steve Jobs. So I thought I'd just bring her on and let her tell us a little bit about that.
So hold that thought on early days, and let's skip forward a little bit to Eva Way.
All right. Hello, Eva. Is that you? Can you hear me? Now I hear her. Okay.
Now you hear me. Good. Well, you're hearing me through the Apple, my iPhone. So there we go. Through the latest technology.
Great.
So, you've been hearing some of Daniel's story, Eva?
I've actually only heard the last couple of minutes. I hope that I'm able to get a podcast of this later so that I can hear the whole thing because I've actually been in a commitment. So I've only just ducked out to make this phone call. So I heard a few minutes of it, but I want to hear the whole thing.
Dude, it's Yom Kippur. That's right. And you only have a few minutes right now, so we just thought we'd bring you on. That you and Sun had a history with Apple at one point, too.
Yeah, we did. Sun, I don't know if she talked about this, but Sun brought the Macintosh to Abacus. And Abacus was a company that had been very early in desktop publishing, and we had actually rigged up a vanilla clone PC as a front end to a typesetting machine before the Mac.
Yeah, so in the 80s, we were trying to become a real computer company. So we had a clone.
In the early 80s, about 83. And then you came along, son, and you brought the Mac, and you said, oh, no, you guys, forget it. You're just like Rube Goldberging this thing, and you could just use a Mac. So you brought the Mac into our desktop publishing business. And then we became so in love with it that we became Apple value-added resellers and ended up being Apple's 20th largest dealer nationwide out of one little storefront. So we sold a lot of Macs.
And that was in the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. Before that, we were like an artist collective doing house cleaning with a free newspaper. And we started using the Mac, and we became like this Mac resource in San Francisco. Steve Jobs had a really big influence on our lives by creating that stuff, but our relationship with Apple was actually during the John Sculley days.
It was during the John Sculley days, yes, and we became value-added resellers. We became known for network integration, so we networked integrated all of the Macs that got installed at the United Airlines maintenance base out at the airport, and we did other very large installations like that, and we did a lot of early animation on the Mac. But what was interesting about our relationship with Steve was later, after we became big Apple dealers, we became compact dealers, and then we wanted to expand into Frontiers. So we met Steve when he was with Next.
On the Next computer, Next. After Apple.
Yeah, we were some of the few people that actually sold a Next computer. A Next computer.
Wow.
A Next. I think we actually sold about three Next computers altogether. But we became one of the very early Next dealers.
Did Steve convince you to sell them? Did he have his UFO-given sales ability then?
Yes, he did. We were in a meeting with him at Next. Son, were you in that meeting
with
us?
Yes, that's when I met him.
Yes, and he was very charismatic. He did all the things that you read about in every bio of him. You know, jumped up in the middle of the meeting all animated and ran to the chalkboard and made diagrams and told us about the future of computing and how the next operating system was going to be right at the center of it. And the next computer was physically beautiful, but it was also brilliantly designed. It was very complicated. And as you explained, son, and I'm sure you can explain further on air, it had internet networking capabilities, but it was before the internet.
Yeah, so it had ISDN. You could see all of the computers in the network as icons on your screen. So it was really something you had never seen before, you know?
So Steve was into networking really early in the game.
Yeah,
he was with the Macintosh, because the Macintosh, you know, that was the whole thing, that it was a plug-and-play networkable computer with other Macs, right?
Yeah, I remember the early video connections with the Macs. They call it Jell-O Vision, because everything was kind of wobbly and very slow frame rate. But it worked. It worked. It was really cool. Plug-and-play networking.
Also, when Apple was first selling laser printers, before laser printers became ubiquitous.
Yeah, the desktop publishing revolution.
Right, that was also plug-and-play. You just got your Mac, you got three Macs, you got one laser printer, and boom, you were networked into printing. And that was very easy and very simple.
That seemed to be a hallmark of Apple in Steve's mentality, wouldn't you say, Daniel?
Exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. Because then with the Next, he took it to a different level with ISDN before the rest of us even knew what it was all about.
The only thing that doesn't make sense to me is, why would the Next be hard to use if Steve's whole mentality was to make things plug and play and easy to use?
Well, the Next, you can't say anything was easy or hard. It was all for the first time. That whole era was the Think Different era. We were really celebrating technology as this way of making the world a better place, and the idea that you should be open to constantly learning new things that had never been available before, because it would give us the ability to change the future. That was really fresh. Like, that was what people with ideals were putting their energy into, you know?
Yes, that's a really good point. It's not easy or hard, it's first.
Right, and it's
first
beginning
means
of
different. Mm-hmm. And different means you have to learn new things. And the emotion that one feels when learning new things is generally, oh, this is challenging. Now, usually there's a great satisfaction, and then once you realize what the new things can do and you know how to do it, you say, oh, wow, this is so easy relative to what it can do. But before it's easy, there's a learning curve.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you, Eva. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Have a really wonderful Yom Kippur.
Thank you. And I will be able to hear this on podcast, right?
Absolutely.
You know it.
Okay, good. So I'm sending a shout out. Eva, can you hear me?
Can you hear Daniel?
I can, my dear.
Hello. I knew you before I knew Sun, you know?
That's amazing.
Well, I knew you before Sun, too.
Yeah, because I came to Carista parties in San Francisco.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And we were all Apple. That was our big claim to fame, was all about that. Although that was actually before Apple, because we didn't get to Apple till we got Sun.
That's right.
All right, listen, folks, we're getting pretty close to the top of the hour here. We got a couple of minutes of breaks of sponsor ads before we do that. So I just want to thank you for calling in and sharing a little bit of your memories of those grand old days, Eva.
Take care, sweetie.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling, Eva. And then after the break, we'll get back to some more of your story with Steve. We'll take a few calls for people who may, if you're open to that, are you open to people asking you questions?
Absolutely.
Great, great.
All right.
Good. It's a fascinating chapter, both locally and globally. This is what we call a true hyper-local story.
Okay. All right. So I think that's everything for now. Nikki, we're going to go to breaks, and we'll be back after that. Okay?
My name is Nikki Phelps.
Up next, we got the second hour of the Saturday special. Stay tuned. KSCO Santa Cruz, I'm Nikki James.
Oh, hello, darling. I hate to hang up on you.
This is Sun.
Welcome
Ryland,
back.
Can you hear me?
Our Steve Jobs Memorial today with Dan Kottke, Steve's best friend.
Yeah. Hi, everybody.
I'm sorry, baby, but I really gotta go to KSCO Radio. Bye.
Can you hear me, Sun?
Yeah, we can
hear
you,
Dan. Look who's joined us. Ryland is here.
Oh, hi, Ryland.
Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, this is Daniel's son, Ryland.
This is local cable.
This is local radio, AM radio in Santa Cruz.
And streaming on KSCO.com.
Nice.
There.
Oh.
We have Dan Kottke and his son, Ryland, on. Dan was Steve Jobs' best friend in the 70s, especially, I think, the early formative years of Apple.
Yeah, those years in the garage when the legend became known.
We want to replay that 2-minute piece from Mawaz, you guys, so that he's brought a little bit into the fold here. He said something really memorable about Steve, and then we'll bring you back up in about 2 minutes. Okay, Dan?
Okay.
Okay, here we go.
I was so stunned because I have very dramatic memories of where I was when the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan, when I heard that JFK had been shot, and this I'll never get this memory out of my head, just where I was, just getting a phone call from a reporter. And they just said, have you heard the news? And I instantly knew what that meant. And it was just a total shock. Like, what do you say? It's like the world lost a John Lennon. I mean, Steve was clearly the most outstanding business thinker. And almost everybody who's high up in the technology business recognized that somehow he had the ability to think out new ways of doing things. Not just ways to improve what we have, do a better version of something, but do it in a totally different way that the world would swing towards. And then I think back to just all the times we had together, very, very good times that you have when you're young, you know, and playing around with the systems and little misbehavior and doing interesting things. And then he was always thinking about certain technology, the early products that got developed, the building parts, what those might lead to in our future. And he was always pushing me as an engineer. Could you possibly add this someday? Could you possibly add that someday? Yes, 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 I could, thinking, no, it's way, way off. But eventually we all did. We went into the garage when we were two young people with no money. You have to work out of your home. We had jobs on the side. We had nobody that could loan us money. We had no business experience. We're like a million young people who are so excited about the future they might have someday in business, making something just out of their ideas. That's what we were. And over and over and over, all the products of Apple, from, you know, iPhones and iPads, iPods, these were just unbelievable life changers. And almost everyone who heads a technology company looks at Steve Jobs as, where did he get the ideas to do it the right way? We were just the lucky partnership. He was lucky to have me in the beginning, but I am much, you know, incredibly lucky to him for everything in my life. He gets a reputation for being a strong leader and being brash, but to me, he was just always so kind, such a good friend, and I'm just going to miss him.
All right, Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple. Thank you very much.
Yeah. You know, I've always been kind of a Woz guy in terms of my relationship with Apple, very much in the sweet nerd camp, but boy, Steve Jobs, without that energy, where would we all be today, right?
But what was it about the brashness? Is that true, Dan? Was it, did you experience Steve's brashness?
Sure. Brash is a very mild term.
Well, what was it more like? Did he sometimes fire people for no reason, or just because he was in a bad mood, or
well,
what?
I don't.
Nothing that you know him personally along those lines.
I don't actually know of anyone that he ever fired, to tell you the truth.
Well, there you go. So it's just the urban legend.
He had a common thing that he would do. He would do unexpected things on job interviews to see how people would react.
Can you give me an example?
Well, no. Actually, I'm not thinking. Oh, sorry, my phone's ringing.
Yeah.
In this film, Something Ventured, Mike Markla talks about how Steve would put his.
Hey, Daniel, can you take?
It's going to stop in a minute.
Okay.
So Mike Markla would take his
bare feet up on the boardroom meeting table, and Mike Markla said, "That's not acceptable. You can leave the room." So Mike said, well, that was, you know, Steve had to know the limits, and then he never did it again. There were many stories of things that he did to job interviews to kind of rattle them. And
like I've heard, or at least I've read some of the sites, that he would ask someone if they'd ever taken acid, things
like
that.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah. And he would do it to particularly straight people employing, you know, to who he knew the answer to and enjoyed their wiggling, it seemed.
Yes.
You know, that's probably not the best thing to talk about on his memorial. But I do remember there were a lot of conversations about, what did you say, he had a strong reality distortion field.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because he was very persistent and insistent when there was something he wanted, which was often the case. In particular, you would say, Steve was very good at getting you to think that what you really wanted to do happened to be what he wanted. He was very good at persuading people, and he had a great talent for inspiring people to do good work. And then, you know, the flip side was, if he didn't like your work,
he'd let you know, huh?
Yes. It was kind of a hero devil kind of a style.
Well, let's take it back to the beginning of the Mac. Now, you were on the original Mac team, right?
Yeah, I was about the sixth person to join. Andy Hertzfeld and I joined the same week.
Okay. Now, did Steve actively recruit you all to become part of this?
Steve did recruit me, and I was very grateful. At the time, I was a very frustrated technician on the Apple III project. I was happy enough working on the Apple III, but, I mean, that product had kind of, I mean, it was shipping. You know?
Yeah, I so remember the Apple III. Yeah. I mean, that was a problem machine, from what I remember, is that it was trying to do so much, and it was trying to take the Apple II to its next level, and somehow it just got complicated.
Well, it was a very simple story. The board, to tell the story, so the Apple II couldn't have the video built in because it radiated too much, and the FCC made it illegal. It was illegal. We didn't have FCC certification is what I'm trying
to
say.
For the Apple II, so you had to...
For the Apple II, yes. Yeah. And so those M&R Channel 3 modulators, Apple was not even allowed to sell them. The whole appeal of the Apple II is you could use your home television on Channel 3. That was the display. That was a brilliant trick. But it wasn't quite legal. So for the Apple III, in order to really guarantee that we wouldn't have a problem with the FCC, we made the entire case out of one big casting of aluminum. It was a boat anchor case. That was fine, except it overheated. Steve refused to allow the idea of having a fan because it would have been too noisy.
That was a big thing, the noise. I remember the Mac never had fans either.
Yes. So my MacBook right in front of me now, the fan is running. It's rather quiet. Anyway, the problem on the Apple III was that because it was a tight space, the big RAM array, which was a lot of chips, that was on a separate board. It was on a daughter board that plugged onto the main board. Someone had decided not to pay for gold contacts. So they had these tin contacts on the RAM array board. The Apple III always worked perfectly on the lab bench. I'm the one who built them, and they always worked perfectly. But when they got into shipping, because it was so hot in the case, the tin contacts oxidized, and the RAM signals, which were high-frequency signals and critical to the computer, right?
Oh, man, that's
so it would that's why it would crash.
Yeah, geez.
It took a few months to figure that out, but unfortunately, many computers had to be recalled and retrofitted. Mm-hmm. It was unfortunate because it was, you know, that's really what you don't want on a new product.
Gotcha. So you're dealing with these issues when Steve recruited you for a whole nother different project. Now, the Mac project. Now, the Mac project, I believe, got a reputation for being a little separate from the rest of the company. Was that true?
And everybody said it was like teacher's pet.
Yeah, you were teacher's pet. Did you have that impression yourself being in it?
Well, sure. Yeah, it was definitely.
You were teacher's pet.
The Mac project was started by Jeff Raskin completely on his own. Jeff is the unsung hero. Well, he's, you know, his praises are sung, but he and Steve had a power showdown and Jeff lost. So that was unfortunate. I don't think Jeff really ever made peace with Steve. And he died of pancreatic cancer also.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
Yes.
When the Mac project started, it was just the circuit board was that big. That's how big the prototype
was. Your hands,
but it has
the size of your face.
68, yeah, size
of the
size.
This is radio. You have to be a little more.
Right.
Theater of the mind.
Theater of the mind. Anyway, it was a tiny prototype in Mark LeBrun's office in the publications section, not even in the hardware department. And Mark LeBrun had this little tiny prototype with a 6809 processor, a 16-bit processor, which was a step up from the 6502. And Burl Smith just kind of designed it in his spare time, the same way Woz designed the Apple I and the Apple II.
What were you recruited to do on the Mac team?
Oh, well, there was so much to do. You know, Burl was really overloaded. He had done the main architecture of the core part of the computer, but we knew it was going to be changing a lot. And so the thing, there's no question of where to start. I started building more copies of them. There was one Macintosh wire app prototype when I started, and I started making more of them. So I was a replicant. I shared the office with Burl.
Okay, so this was in 82?
January of 81.
January of 81. Okay, yeah. So really, the Apple II was really the meat and potatoes of Apple at the time. It was making all the money.
Yes.
And so this was an R&D project. Was, the story goes that it was inspired by Steve's visit to Xerox PARC and saw their full graphical user interface with mice and folders on the screen, the whole nine yards of today's GUI.
Yes.
Were you part of that? Did you get to see the Xerox PARC prototypes for the future?
Yes, I was on that trip. I was just a lab tech at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I was very grateful to be included. I didn't know anything about Xerox PARC or Altos. I didn't know anything about that bigger world of computer culture.
Was it as inspiring as the stories lead us to believe?
I was like in the Cave of Treasures.
I guess so then.
I was completely dumbfounded when we went to go see the Alto.
Uh-huh.
And because I was on the hardware side, I was asking hardware questions. I had never heard of a bit slice architecture. And on the Alto, there was no instruction set. That is to say, the instruction set of the processor had to be loaded before you could boot the processor. So you had to first boot the instruction set. The term bootstrapping, that's pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had never heard of such a thing. I was dumbfounded.
So this level of the conversation is a little bit hard for me because, you know, it's very gearhead. Tech-centric.
Shall we move it into the emotional planes here?
Yeah, and I'm wondering, can we talk about things like maybe the movies that were made about this time in Mac history, or the people?
Let's look at the social elements, because there was a point where you kind of really pissed off Steve, right? Are you willing to talk about that on the air at all?
Oh, well, there were various, you know, phases to it.
Yeah, I mean, where he really got mad at you and, you know.
The time he was really mad at me was 1982, the story in brief was, I didn't realize that he was publicly denying that he had this child.
He had a child out of wedlock with the girlfriend?
He had a child out of wedlock with Chris Ann, and as his friend, mm-hmm. I was a little bit well, ashamed isn't the right word, but as his friend...
You try talking to him about it?
No, never really talked to him about it.
Judgmental. You thought less of him.
I wasn't judgmental. No. I wasn't supporting him to be denying his child. That's all I'm trying to say. Mike Moritz was writing a book called The Little Kingdom. Steve had all given us permission to talk to Michael Moritz. Mm-hmm. And Michael Moritz kind of set me up after I had talked with him for hours. And then he calls me up and says, oh, I just have one more question for you. Could you confirm that Steve has a daughter named Lisa? And we had the Lisa computer was just about to be announced. It started shipping in 1983. Anyway, so I said something like, oh, it's not a secret. And the Time magazine reporter was on the line, and that was the phone call that killed his consideration for Man of the Year for Time magazine. And I didn't know that. I had no way of knowing that. Yeah. And Michael Moritz really kind of set me up to be the fall guy for that.
Yeah, so what did Steve take offense to, exactly?
Well, Steve reasonably felt like I was violating his private life, which I kind of was. I mean, really, nowadays, if you're an employee of a corporation and someone asks you a question about an executive at the corporation, you're never going to make a comment. Never. You would lose your job, right?
Yeah.
But those were simpler times.
Yeah.
We didn't have a PR department per se at the time.
Did Time publish that then? Did they publish something you said about how you didn't think you should be Man of the Year?
Steve Jobs Man of the Year story, and they made it the Computer of the Year. That was 1982.
Oh, instead of Steve as being the Man of the Year.
Yeah. Anyway, Steve was very hurt. I didn't even know why. I think I would have apologized at the time, but I didn't really know what I was apologizing for because I didn't think I had really given away any big secret.
But that calling him a deadbeat dad, basically?
Oh, no, I definitely wasn't doing that. All I did is confirm that he had a daughter. I didn't know that he had been denying it.
Oh, really?
And why would you think?
Okay, because
what's that?
Because I had heard that he had tried to prove that he wasn't in paternity.
Why was he denying his daughter? I don't know. John Lennon denied that he was married and had a child as well. Okay.
Maybe it was something about men of that era. Women are burning their bras. Men are denying that they're fathers.
Yes. Well, it's very poignant. You know, John Lennon did the same thing. He felt abandoned by his father. And so then when he had a child with Cynthia, it was denied publicly. And that wasn't John Lennon's idea. I think it was his manager's idea, Brian Epstein, right? Funny thing is, Steve had a psychological complex of sorts about being adopted. It was traumatic. It wasn't an event, but it was a big issue for him psychologically. And the year before Apple started, as soon as Steve had money from working at Atari, he took Primal Therapy. Hmm. I remember asking him why he was interested in that. Therapy had no interest for me. Primal Therapy was a new thing, which he had heard about. Arthur Yanov was the...
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, Steve said it was because he had to get at the core of his feelings of abandonment.
Yeah, deep-seated issues of abandonment.
Given up for adoption.
Wow. Well, he never did really reconcile with his biological dad either, from what I understand.
I don't know. I know he tracked down his mother and had a relationship with his biological mother.
Oh, good. Good. So what did he do at the time? So he got really angry. Did he express it overtly towards you at the time?
Oh, I came into work one morning. This was in the Macintosh on Bandley Drive.
Uh-huh.
So it was a big space. There was a kind of like a big lobby area, and everybody's cubicle kind of opened onto the center space.
Yeah.
And Steve dressed me down publicly in front of many people.
Really? Make you stand
up? Oh, he was just angry. And he basically said, I should fire you. But he didn't. I remember feeling apologetic, but I didn't really... He didn't explain what he was so angry about, and I knew it had something to do with talking to a reporter. But really, I had only talked to Michael Moritz, and he had given us permission to do that. That's why I'm saying Michael Moritz kind of set me up. Anyway.
So what was the outcome of this?
Oh, the outcome is Steve didn't talk to me for about 15 years.
Is it true that he denied you stock in the company at that point?
Well, the stock issue came up in 1980. Apple went public in November of 1980, and when that happened, I didn't have a stock option. I was a technician. You know, there was nobody even to talk to. The only person to talk to about stock was the person who hired you. And because I had been there since the beginning, I didn't really have anyone to talk to about the stock. Rod Holt was the engineering vice president. He had approached Steve about giving me some stock. Mm-hmm. And Steve said zero.
Really? Wow. And that was before he was angry at you for this?
Yeah, it was years before.
Wow.
And I have no idea why he said that. I never knew. That was at a time when I still considered us friends. And I didn't hear this story till years later. So I was very hurt when I heard that. And I thought, I was hoping Steve would live longer and we would have a little reconciliation sometime.
Yeah.
But didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Woz did help reconcile it a little bit in terms of the stock issue, didn't he?
Yes, that's right. So I didn't get the $1 million deal that all the other engineers got. Woz gave me some modest amount of stock, 1,000 shares or something. At the time, it was worth under $50,000. So it was kind of like a bonus.
Yeah.
But I held on to it. I was very thrifty, frugal. I was very frugal. I held on to it.
Nate, fantastic. Well, congrats. It's got to be worth a lot now.
It is worth a lot now. No thanks to my accountant who told me for years to dump it.
Good.
We'll pick up with this after we hear from our sponsors. And this is the Saturday special with Dr. Future, Mrs. Future, and Steve Jobs' one-time best friend, Daniel Kottke, remembering Steve Jobs and the Apple years. See ya after the break.
Welcome back to the Saturday special. MZ is celebrating Yom Kippur today, and we're doing a Steve Jobs memorial with Steve's best friend, Dan Kottke. And Dan, we just had a query from the audience.
They're curious, where did the Apple name and emblem come from? What do you know about that, Daniel? Got any thoughts on that matter?
Well, so here's an anecdote. Jobs and Woz couldn't agree on what to name their little company, and the number two choice of name for Apple was Matrix Computer.
Matrix. That's funny.
Like the movie.
This happened in the spring of 76. Steve Jobs told me this years later. But the name Apple came because Steve had found Arnold Arendt's books called The Mucusless Diet Healing System about the fruitarian diet. Mm-hmm. And Steve and I, in 1975, had gone up to visit Robert Friedland's farm in Oregon, which was called All One Farm in McMinnville, Oregon, not far from where Kesey landed. Mm-hmm. In fact, I suppose Kesey was there in the neighborhood at the time. I didn't know that. There was a large apple orchard on the farm, and I guess we were there at the right time of the late summer. We did apple harvest, and Steve and I both fasted on apples for a week, which makes you a little lightheaded, you know? It's just like sugar.
Were they Macintoshes?
I don't even know what kind of apples they were. So that's why the apple was kind of in our consciousness. And I suppose Steve was a fan of the Beatles, mm-hmm. So that may have had a little play on it. The logo, I don't know who designed the logo with the apple with the bite taken out.
There was an original one with Newton, wasn't there?
The very first logo was designed by Ron Wayne, and it had the quote, "A mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought alone." I don't know where he got that quote. It was about Newton. It was something that someone had said about Isaac Newton, and so the logo he designed was an apple tree with an apple hanging and Newton sitting on the ground below it. That was the Apple One operation manual, had that logo on it.
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting logo, but a little complex compared to the current one.
Anyway, here's the third part of the story. So I don't know who came up with the modern black logo. I'm sure Mike Scott had a lot to do with it because he was Apple's president from the beginning. I think it was probably Mike Scott was a very strong, dynamic president for Apple. Steve Jobs was like, you know, VP of operations, I think was his title, vague title. The other part of the story I'm going to mention is Chuck Colby had a painting in his dining room that was a circle with bands of color.
Oh, okay.
Chuck knew Woz from the homebrew days.
Yeah, yeah.
And Woz was over at Chuck's house for dinner and looked at the wall and saw the colored bars and said, that's kind of cool. And then, as Chuck said, the next thing he knew, he saw the same colored bars show up on the Apple logo. It was a fine art painting that Chuck had in his living room.
That's too cool.
Chuck was telling me this just last week. So he's asking for me to help him set the Wikipedia record straight on the origin of the colored bar logo.
For the uninitiated, Chuck Colby is an inventor in Silicon Valley. He's kind of different inventions. A lot of them have to do with the Apple computers.
Yeah.
He supposedly had the first portable Macintosh, for example.
Oh, he definitely did. He did. And Chuck is a very prolific inventor, and now he started a company called Tesla Robotics. He's got a iPad-based telepresence robot.
Nice. So it'll actually do useful things around the house?
Yeah, and I'm flattered that he says he wants to hire me, but we'll see if we can find some funding.
Yeah. Well, we'll get him back on the Dr. Future show. We've had him on once before, but I want to hear about his robot.
Yes.
Meanwhile, we do have another question. People are wondering about why the fascination with type fonts for the Macintosh. Why was it so type font oriented? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it was a key design element of the Macintosh that it was going to be a bitmapped display. That was an expensive and radical thing to do. The Apple II line, the Apple III had a downloadable font. Okay, people don't all know that, but that was one of the features of the Apple III, is that the character generator, which was a hard chip on the Apple II, we made a little memory store so you could change the font kind of on the fly. Mm-hmm. And that's how we did the cursor on the Apple III. It was a little bizarre, but you want a cursor to go in between two letters. On the Apple II, the cursor highlit a letter, and you were never sure whether the insertion point was before or after the highlit letter. Okay, so on the Apple III, the cursor was a special character, and that character was reprogrammed on the fly to be whatever character was under it with the cursor bar. Mm-hmm. So it was clear that the cursor bar was in between two characters, and that was a clever thing to do. Nobody really knew about it or noticed it. The IBM PC came out, which didn't have that feature. Anyway, back to the bitmap display, it was just fortuitous that PostScript was being created at that time, and Steve found out about PostScript, and it was a natural fit. It was kind of a no-brainer, I'm sure Steve would say that, to put that on the Macintosh. So it was really just the capability. People may not understand the reason bitmap displays were rare is because RAM was very expensive, and to do a bitmap display, you're dedicating a whole bunch of RAM just to the screen.
We have a call now.
Well, actually, what we have is a question. Our callers are just submitting some questions here. The question is, did you know the Baums who supposedly helped with the startup money for Apple?
Oh, yes, sure. Elmer Baum. How did Elmer know Steve? I don't even know. But Elmer was a retired, he had a very long career in hardware. I don't know. I suppose Elmer probably came to a Homebrew Computer Club meeting. And I guess Elmer had made a loan of some money to the two Steves. I don't think he had stock. I know how it was. Yes, it was Alan Baum, who was a high school classmate of Woz's. And Alan was very instrumental in helping the Apple I. He helped Woz write the monitor code for the Apple I. So the monitor is the core code in PROM that gives you the prompt on the screen and does the basic routines. Hmm. Anyway, that's probably how Elmer came to show up. Elmer did all the power supply testing for the Apple II. He worked at the very bench right next to me. I was doing the logic boards, and Elmer did the power supplies.
Well, here's a real Santa Cruz question. Is it true that Steve was familiar with psychedelics? And if so, which ones?
Well, all we had was LSD. And I never wanted to get pegged as the one who was giving LSD to Steve. But actually, it was me. We had LSD in high school.
High school, really?
Yeah. Starting in 10th grade.
Oh, but that was before you knew Steve.
Yeah, years before I knew Steve. But I had Orange Sunshine in 10th grade. It was a life-changing event.
Yeah.
And it was such a delight many years later to meet Nick Sands at Burning Man, who created Orange Sunshine. Thank you, Nick.
There's a documentary coming out on Orange Sunshine. You can do a Google search on it. You'll find
it interesting. I know that.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the Shulgin film has just come out. It's called Dirty Pictures. It's showing next week in San Francisco.
Hmm. So that was a combination of Eastern spirituality and LSD then, as part of Steve's early spiritual awakening.
Yes, that's very true. And Steve and I also bonded over going to the Hare Krishna love feast every Sunday night. You know, we were poor students. You know, Reed had a food plan. Steve wasn't even on the food plan. Steve had no money. I'll tell you, in his Reed days, Steve's number one staple diet was Malto meal. No, Roman meal. That's what it was called. It was Roman meal. It was just wheat, hot cereal. You could buy a box of it for $1.20, and you could live for a week. So he was living in Steve was renting a room above a garage in the suburbs near Reed and hanging out on campus and, you know, hanging out with me. He had other friends too. I'm not really sure who.
Here's another question. When were you closest with Steve and what did you share then?
Oh, I'd say closest was when we were together for 4 months in India. You know, he was a great traveling companion. I was a little perplexed that he would get into he was kind of a ferocious negotiator. And the thing that really bothered him mm-hmm. was we were easily a foot taller than all of the Indians. Indians tend to be shorter people. We were these tall Americans who really stood out. And so you'd go to the fruit market or the mm-hmm. vegetable market, and you know what? Indians, there's a different price for everybody, right? We were not going to buy lemons for the price that the locals bought lemons for because we were rich Americans, even though we didn't feel rich. But the rupee would buy there what a dollar would buy here, but the rupee was 12 cents. So Steve would get into these arguments with the vegetable sellers.
To get the local prices. Huh?
He would watch what people are paying for something, and he wanted that price. Okay? And it was pennies. It was pennies. And I was happy to pay whatever they wanted to charge me, okay? Yeah. So there's a little bit of his personality showing through. He had a kind of, you know, his father was Syrian. He had a kind of Middle Eastern bargainer mentality, okay? And that came up several times during our travel to India.
Well, his biological dad was Syrian, so.
Yes, that's right. I never knew his dad's name until I saw it in the New York Times yesterday.
Well, listen, we have a phone call from our friend Gabby in New Jersey. Let's go to Gabby, okay? Ready?
All right.
Hi, Gabby.
Hey, Sonny.
Well, glad you're listening to the show.
Hey, Gabby. Gabby.
Hey, Dr. Future.
And Daniel, too.
Hi, Daniel.
Hello, Gabrielle.
Hello, Daniel.
You have a question for Daniel?
I do have a question, and I'm glad that I caught you because we were out all day. But I was wondering, Daniel, if you were at all instrumental in Steve Jobs reuniting or uniting with his oldest daughter, Lisa.
Wow, what a question. No, I had nothing to do with that. That happened at a time, you know, I didn't talk to Steve from about 1982. Even though I was working on the Mac project until 1984, Steve would just walk right past me. He wouldn't really talk to me. And I felt bad, but he was already launched onto the big, famous, wealthy, important entrepreneur part of his career. And so I was just kind of another engineer on the staff. And Lisa and Chris Ann did live in my house in 1981.
Oh, that wow.
was when Lisa was 3 years old.
But so do you keep in touch with them now?
Oh, I stay in close touch with Chris Ann, reasonably close touch. Lisa, I haven't talked to in a very long time, but I wrote her a long letter yesterday.
Oh.
Is she married now, Lisa?
I don't even know. She's in her 30s. She was born in 78.
I remember her at a party at my place back in 86. And she was quite a cute girl.
A little. Yeah. What was she like? 3 years old then?
Six, I think.
Six. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't. I never saw her since the age of six. I don't think.
Well, what do you know about their reunion, or is this merely not something that you really know anything about?
No, I just don't know about it. It's just that Lisa was a headstrong teenager, and by the time she was 14, she had an argument with her mom, and said, "I'm going to live with my dad." I don't know how much Steve really welcomed her. I think I heard later from Chris Ann that she didn't quite get the warm welcome she wanted at her dad's house, but I don't know any more about it.
Right.
Very interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks,
yeah,
for that,
thanks
Gabby.
For checking in, Gabby.
Sure. I love you guys.
Love right. you, Gabby. Okay.
Yeah, I love you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Gabby lives in New Jersey and was in the epicenter of that Hurricane Irene recently.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you mentioned that Steve had reconciled with you to some extent towards the end. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, what happened is Albert Hoffman wrote a letter to Steve Jobs at the encouragement of Rick Doblin, I think. Rick Doblin, founder of MAPS, the psychedelic research advocacy group. And so Albert Hoffman was 101 years old, and because Steve had made public statements about the value of LSD in his life, mm-hmm. I heard about this and I volunteered to deliver the letter to Steve personally.
Oh.
As a, you know, I don't know, I thought Steve would appreciate it.
Sure.
And so as it turned, what happened? I guess I sent Steve a couple of emails and made the introduction to Rick Doblin, and then Rick Doblin sent him the letter. But then what happened is Steve called me up at 7 in the morning some months later. This was like 2009. He calls me up at 7 apologizing, but saying that was the only free time he had all day. And we chatted for 20 minutes mm-hmm. and had a very nice conversation.
Mm.
It was heartwarming to hear from him.
After all those years, what, it was like 15, 20 years, something like that?
It had been probably 15 years, yeah.
Wow.
And I asked him at one point what he thought at this point in his life, having such a remarkable life. I said, what do you think now about reincarnation? Because that had been a topic of our discussions.
Oh, he did. Wow.
So I asked him what he thought about reincarnation. Mm-hmm. And he goes, 50-50. I thought that was funny.
Would he be the kind of guy that would consider like freezing himself? Or do you think,
oh, no.
Or do you think he would just go for the death experience?
Well, his great Stanford commencement speech of 2005,
yeah.
there's a whole passage there about death is nature's way of making room for new things.
Mm-hmm.
That's very profound. That was an incredible speech.
Yeah, nobody wants to die. I listened to that just recently. It is an amazing speech.
That line is debatable, actually. Some people do want to die. In fact, many people want to die. Some people want to die and can't.
Yeah, but there's a primal force that keeps even the insects stopping us from killing them. I mean, there is a fundamental desire to be alive, to stay alive, for most anyway.
Yes.
You can't. So.
Well, one of the great takeaways from Steve's life is he was very much an alive person. He was in the now, actualizing his visions. And that's something that we can all think of as a life goal.
Staying in the now. So he was a power of now guy before it became a popular way of thinking about time.
Yes, that's very true. Very true. And you could see the roots of that in his great interest in Zen.
Mm-hmm.
His main mentor as an adult was Kobun Chino, who was the Roshi of the Los Altos Zendo.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a book being written about Kobun now. It's a strange story. Kobun's son... Mm-hmm. or daughter, I'm not sure which, they were at Vanya Palmer's house in England.
Mm-hmm.
His child fell into the pond. The water was very cold. Kobun dived in to rescue his child, and they both drowned. Very odd and surprising and sad story for a Zen master, right? Zen master, you think of Yoda, right?
Yeah.
With powers, right? We're anyway. I wrote to Steve 2 months ago to tell him that there's a book being written about Kobun Chino and maybe he wants to contribute some memories. And maybe he did, but I never heard back.
Hmm. So what was the last time you saw him?
Last time I saw Steve was at the Apple Cafeteria last summer. I went to go have lunch with Wendell Sander, who was the designer of the Apple III. Wendell was retiring from Apple after a very long career. And Wendell and I are walking through the cafeteria, and there's Steve Jobs just kind of walking around greeting people, which is very uncharacteristic of his personality. But he was happy.
Yeah.
And it was really good to see.
That was in June this year?
We just had a brief chat. No. This was in the summer of 2010.
Oh, 2010, last year.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So it was actually reasonably healthy.
So we're down to about 2 minutes here, and I'm just wondering if you have any kind of parting thoughts, like reminiscence or something like that Steve's passing has helped you to look at or feel.
If I can just express this quickly, I'll just say I was approached by NPR, National Public Radio, to give an audio interview many months ago, four or five, back in February. And Peter John Schuller apologized, and he said, this is a sensitive subject, but this is for Steve's obituary. Mm. And you know what? It was a really healing experience for me to be talking about my friend because Steve hurt me a lot at a certain time in my life. Not like I hadn't forgiven him long ago, but it was very therapeutic to be talking about someone from the point of view of an obituary. Mm. And I was thinking at the time, wow, we should all be so fortunate as to have our friends be interviewed for our obituary before we leave the earth.
So you can kind of go to your own funeral in a way.
Yes. Well,
see how much you're loved.
Because it allows an opening up and a forgiveness and an appreciation, you know. And there was a part of Steve that I loved very much and cared about. So it was difficult for me to lose that friendship for many years. Mm. I was looking forward to more of a reconciliation with him if he had lasted longer. But anyway, love you, Steve. We'll miss you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Daniel. It's really been great reminiscing with you.
Yeah, thanks for being on the show, Dan.
This has been the Saturday Special on KSCO Santa Cruz with Dr. Future and Mrs. Future. And we've been remembering Steve Jobs with our friends Daniel Kottke and a few others.
Yeah, so. Dan was best friends with Steve for many, many years. Thanks for listening, folks. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Good morning. Now stay right here on KSCO Radio.